down. Robin shook her head, though nobody was there to see her do it, returned the tarot cards to their box, climbed into bed, set her alarm, and turned out the light. Chapter 46. Whereas that pagan proud himself did rest, in secret shadow by a fountain side, even he it was that erst would have suppressed fair Una. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Robin's night was punctuated with sudden wakings from a succession of anxious dreams. That she'd fallen asleep at the wheel again, or had overslept, and arrived at the gallery to find Satchwell's exhibition gone. When the alarm on her mobile rang at 7 a.m, she forced herself immediately out of bed, showered, dressed, and glad to leave the impersonal bedroom, headed downstairs with her packed hold-all to eat muesli and drink coffee in the dining room, which was painted an oppressive sludge green. The day outside was fresh but overcast, a cold silver sun trying to penetrate the cloud. Having returned her hold-all to the Park Land Rover, she headed on foot towards the Royal Pump Rooms, which housed the gallery where Satchwell's exhibition was about to open. To her left lay the ornamental Jefferson Gardens and a fountain of pinkish stone that might have been the model for one of Crowley's tarot cards. Four scallop-patterned basins sat at the top. A certain weakness, an abandonment to desire. "You get in like Talbot," Robin told herself crossly. Speeding up, she arrived at the pump rooms with time to spare. The building had just been opened. A young woman in black was walking away from the glass doors, holding a bunch of keys. Robin entered, to find little trace of the Regency pump rooms left inside. The floor was covered in modern grey tiles, the ceiling supported by metal columns. A cafe took up one wing of the open-plan space, a shop another. The gallery, Robin saw, lay across opposite, through more glass doors. It comprised one long room, brick-walled and wooden-floored, which had been temporarily given over to an exhibition of local artists. There were only three people inside: a stocky, grey-bobbed woman in an Alice band, a small man with a hangdog air, whom Robin suspected was her husband, and another young woman in black, who she assumed worked there. The grey-haired woman's voice was echoing around the room, as though it was a gymnasium. "I told Shona that Long Itchington needs an accent light. You can barely see it. This corner's so dark." Robin walked slowly around, looking at canvases and sketches. Five local artists had been given space for the temporary exhibition, but she identified Paul Satchwell's work without difficulty. It had been given a prominent position and stood out boldly among the studies of local landmarks, portraits of pallid Britons standing at bus stops, and still lifes. Naked figures twisted and cavorted in scenes from Greek mythology. Persephone struggled in the arms of Hades as he carried her down into the underworld. Andromeda strained against chains, binding her to rock, as a dragonish creature rose from the waves to devour her. Leda lay supine in bulrushes as Zeus, in the form of a swan, impregnated her. Two lines of Joni Mitchell floated back to Robin as she looked at the paintings. "When I first saw your gallery, I liked the ones of ladies." Except that Robin wasn't sure she liked the paintings. The female figures were all black-haired, olive-skinned, heavy-breasted, and partially or entirely naked. The paintings were accomplished, but Robin found them slightly lascivious. Each of the women wore a similar expression of vacant abandon, and Satchwell seemed to have a definite preference for those myths that featured bondage, rape, or abduction. "Striking, aren't they?" said the meek-faced husband of the angry painter of Long Itchington, appearing at Robin's side to contemplate a picture of a totally naked Io, whose hair streamed behind her and whose breasts gleamed with sweat as she fled a bull with a gargantuan erection. "Hmm," said Robin. "I was wondering whether he was going to come to the exhibition. Paul Satchwell, I mean." "I think he said he's going to pop back in," said the man. "Back? You mean he's here, in England?" "Well, yes," said the man, looking somewhat surprised. "He was here yesterday, anyway. came to see them hung.
"Visiting family, I think he said
the young woman in black, who seemed glad of a reason to talk to somebody other than the fuming artist in the hairband.
"You haven't got contact details for him, have you?"
asked Robin.
"Maybe the address of where he's staying."
"No," said the young woman, now looking intrigued. Evidently local artists didn't usually engender this much excitement.
"You can leave your name and address, though, if you like, and I'll tell him you want to speak to him if he drops by."
So Robin accompanied the young woman back to the reception area, where she scribbled her name and phone number onto a piece of paper, and then, her heart still beating fast in excitement, went to the cafe, bought herself a cappuccino, and positioned herself beside a long window looking out onto the pump room gardens, where she had a good view of people entering the building. Should she book back into the Premier Inn and wait here in Leamington Spa until Satchwell showed himself? Would Strike think it worth neglecting their other cases to remain here in the hope of Satchwell turning up? It was Joan's funeral today. She couldn't burden him with a question. She wondered what her partner was doing now, perhaps already dressing for the service. Robin had only ever attended two funerals. Her maternal grandfather had died just before she dropped out of university. She'd gone home for the funeral and never gone back. She remembered very little of the occasion. It had taken everything she'd had to preserve a fragile facade of well-being, and she remembered the strange sense of disembodiment that underlay the eggshell brittleness with which she'd met the half-scared inquiries of family members who knew what had happened to her. She remembered, too, Matthew's hand around hers. He hadn't once dropped it, skipping lectures and an important rugby game to come and be with her. The only other funeral she'd attended had been 4 years previously, when she and Strike had attended the cremation of a murdered girl in the course of their first murder investigation, standing together at the back of the sparsely populated, impersonal crematorium. That had been before Strike had agreed to take her on permanently, when she'd been nothing but a temp whom Strike had allowed to inveigle her way into his investigation. Thinking back to Rochelle Onifade's funeral, Robin realized that even then, the ties binding her to Matthew had been loosening. Robin hadn't yet realized it, but she'd found something she wanted more than she'd wanted to be Matthew's wife. Her coffee finished, Robin made a quick trip to the bathroom, then returned to the gallery in the hope that Satchwell might have entered it while she wasn't watching, but there was no sign of him. A few people had drifted in to wander around the temporary exhibition. Satchwell's paintings were attracting the most interest. Having walked the room once more, Robin pretended an interest in an old water fountain in the corner. Covered in swags and lion's heads with gaping mouths, it had once dispensed the health-giving spa waters. Beyond the font lay another room, which presented a total contrast to the clean, modern space behind her. It was octagonal and made of brick, with a very high ceiling and windows of Bristol blue glass. Robin stepped inside. It was, or had once been, a Turkish hammam, or steam room, and had the appearance of a small temple. At the highest point of the vaulted ceiling was a cupola, decorated with an eight-pointed star in glass, with a lantern hanging from it.
"Nice to see a bit of pagan influence in it."
The voice was a combination of self-conscious Cockney, overlain with the merest whiff of a Greek accent. Robin spun around, and there, planted firmly in the middle of the hammam, in jeans and an old denim shirt, was an elderly man with his left eye covered in a surgical dressing, which stood out, stark white against skin as brown as old terracotta. His straggly white hair fell to his stooping shoulders. White chest hair grew in the space left by his undone buttons. A silver chain hung around his crepe-skin throat, and silver and turquoise rings decorated his fingers.
"You the young lady you wanted to talk to me?"
asked Paul Satchwell, revealing yellow-brown teeth as he smiled.
"Yes," said Robin, "I am. Robin Ellicott," she added, holding out her hand.
His uncovered eyes swept Robin's face and figure with unconcealed appreciation. He held her hand a little too long after shaking it, but Robin continued to smile as she withdrew it and delved in her handbag for a card, which she gave him.
"Private detective,"
said Satchwell, his smile fading a little as he read the card, one-eyed.
"The Earl's orders,"
Robin explained.
"Margot," said Satchwell, looking shocked. "Christ almighty, that's what, 40 years ago?"
"Nearly," said Robin, moving aside to let some tourists claim her spot in the middle of the hammam and read its history off the sign on the wall. "I've come up from London in hopes of talking to you about her. It'd mean a lot to the family if you could tell me whatever you remember."
"Hey, Larry, what do you expect me to remember after all this time?" said Satchwell.
But Robin was confident he was going to accept. She discovered that people generally wanted to know what you already knew, why you'd come to find them, whether they had any reason to worry. And sometimes they wanted to talk because they were lonely or felt neglected, and it was flattering to have somebody hang on your words. And sometimes, as now, elderly as he was, the single eye, which was a cold, pale blue, swept her body and back to her face. They wanted to spend more time with a young woman they found attractive.
"All right, then," said Satchwell slowly. "I don't know what I can tell you, but I'm hungry. Let me take you to lunch."
"That'll be great, but I'll be taking you," said Robin, smiling. "You're doing me the favour."
Chapter 47. The sacred ox that careless stands, with gilden horns and flowery garlands crowned, all suddenly with mortal stroke astound, doth grovelling fall. The martial maid stayed not him to lament, but forward rode, and kept her ready way. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. Satchwell bade the attendant in the art gallery farewell by clasping her hands in a double handshake and assuring her he'd look in later in the week. He even took fulsome leave of the disgruntled painter of Long Itchington, who scowled after him as he left.
"Provincial galleries," he said, chuckling, as he and Robin headed out of the pump rooms.
"Funny seeing my stuff next to that old bat's postcard pictures, though, wasn't it? And a bit of a kick to be exhibited where you were born. I haven't been back here in Christ. Must be 50-odd years. You got a car? Good. We'll get out of here. Go through to Warwick. It's just up the road."
Satchwell kept up a steady stream of talk as they walked towards the Land Rover.
"Never liked Leamington. With only one eye at his service, he had to turn his head in exaggerated fashion to look around. Too genteel for the likes of me."
Robin learned that he'd lived in the spa town only until he was 6, at which point he and his single mother had moved to Warwick. He had a younger half-sister, the result of his mother's second marriage, with whom he was currently staying, and had decided to have his cataract removed while in England.
"Still a British citizen, I'm entitled. So when they asked me," he said, with a grand wave backwards at the Royal Pump Rooms, "if I contribute some paintings, I thought, why not? Brought them over with me."
"They're wonderful," said Robin insincerely.
"Have you got just the one sister?"
She had no aim other than making polite conversation, but out of the corner of her eye, she saw Satchwell's head turn so that his unbandaged eye could look at her.
"No," he said, after a moment or two. I had an older sister too, but she died when we were kids."
"Oh, I'm sorry," said Robin.
"One of those things," said Satchwell. "Severely disabled. Had fits and stuff. She was older than me. I can't remember much about it. Hit my mum hard, obviously."
"I can imagine," said Robin.
They had reached the Land Rover. Robin, who'd already mentally calculated the risk to herself, should Satchwell prove to be dangerous, was confident that she'd be safe by daylight, and given that she had control of the car. She unlocked the doors and climbed into the driver's seat, and Satchwell succeeded in hoisting himself into the passenger seat on his second attempt.
"Yeah, we moved through to Warwick from here after Blanche died," he said, buckling up his seatbelt. "Just me and my mum. Not that Warwick's much better. But it's authentic. Authentic medieval buildings, you know."
Given that he was Midlands born and raised, Robin thought his Cockney accent must be a long-standing affectation. It came and went, mingled with an intonation that was slightly foreign after so many years in Greece. "Whereas this place, the Victorians had their wicked way with it," he said. And as Robin reversed out of her parking space, he said, looking up at the moss-covered face of a stone Queen Victoria, "There she is. Look, miserable old care," and laughed. "State of that building," he added, as they passed the town hall. "That's something me and Crowley had in common for sure. Born here, hated it here." Robin thought she must have misheard. "You and Alistair Crowley?" "Crowley," she repeated, as they drove up the parade. "The occult writer."
"Yeah, he was born here," said Satchwell. "You don't see that in many of the guidebooks because they don't like it. Here, turn left. Go on. It's on our way."
Minutes later, he directed her into Clarendon Square, where tall white terraced houses, though now subdivided into flats, retained a vestige of their old grandeur.
"That's it, where he was born," said Satchwell
with satisfaction, pointing up at number 30.
"No plaque or nothing. They don't like talking about him, the good people of Lemon and Spa."
"I had a bit of a Crowley phase in me youth,"
said Satchwell, as Robin looked up at the large square windows.
"You know, he tortured a cat to death when he was a boy, just to see whether it had nine lives."
"I didn't," said Robin, putting the car into reverse.
"Probably happened in there,"
said Satchwell, with morbid satisfaction. Same as AC, same as AC. Another moment of enlightenment had hit Robin. Talbot had gone looking for identical components between Satchwell's horoscope and Crowley's. The self-proclaimed beast, Baphomet, the wickedest man in the West. LS connection. Of course. Lemington Spa. Why had Talbot decided, months into the investigation, that Satchwell deserved a full horoscope, the only one of the suspects to be so honoured? His alibi appeared watertight, after all. Had the return of suspicion been a symptom of Talbot's illness, triggered by the coincidence of Satchwell and Crowley's place of birth? Or had he uncovered some unrecorded weakness in Satchwell's alibi? Satchwell continued to talk about his life in Greece, his painting, and about his disappointment in how old England was faring, and Robin made appropriate noises at regular intervals while mentally reviewing those features of Satchwell's horoscope that Talbot had found so intriguing. Mars in Capricorn, strong-willed, determined but prone to accidents. Moon in Pisces, neurosis, personality disorders, dishonesty. Leo rising, no sense of moderation. Resents demands on them. They reached Warwick within half an hour, and, as Satchwell had promised, found themselves in a town that could hardly have presented a greater contrast to the wide, sweeping, white-faced crescents of Leamington. An ancient stone arch reminded Robin of Clerkenwell. They passed timber and beam houses, cobbles, steep sloping streets, and narrow alleyways.
"We'll go to the Roebuck," said Satchwell,
when Robin had parked in the market square.
"It's been there forever. Oldest pub in town."
"Wherever you like," said Robin, smiling, as she checked that she had a notebook in her handbag. They walked together through the heart of Warwick, Satchwell pointing out such landmarks as he deemed worth looking at. He was one of those men who felt a need to touch, tapping Robin unnecessarily upon the arm to draw her attention, grasping her elbow as they crossed the street, and generally assuming a proprietorial air over her as they wove their way towards Smith Street.
"Do you mind?"
asked Satchwell, as they drew level with picturesque art supplies, and without waiting for an answer, he led her into the shop where, as he selected brushes and oils, he talked with airy self-importance of modern trends in art and the stupidity of critics.
"Oh, Margot," Robin thought.
But then she imagined the Margot Bamborough she carried with her in her head, judging her, in turn, by Matthew, with his endless store of anecdotes of his own sporting achievements and his increasingly pompous talk of pay rises and bonuses, and felt humbled and apologetic. At last they made it into the Roebuck Inn, a low-beamed pub with a sign of a deer's head hanging outside, and secured a table for two towards the rear of the pub. Robin couldn't help but notice the coincidence. The wall behind Satchwell was dotted with horned animal heads, including a stuffed deer and bronze-coloured models of an antelope and a ram. Even the menus had silhouettes of antlered stag heads upon them. Robin asked the waitress for a Diet Coke, all the while trying to repress thoughts of the horned signs of the Zodiac. "Would it be all right," she asked, smiling, when the waitress had departed for the bar, "if I ask a few questions about Margot now?"
"Yeah, of course," said Satchwell, with a smile that revealed his stained teeth again.
But he immediately picked up the menu card and studied it.
"And do you mind if I take notes?"
Robin asked, pulling out her notebook.
"Go ahead,"
he said, still smiling, watching her over the top of his menu with his uncovered eye, which followed her movements as she opened the book and clicked out the nib of her pen.
"So I apologize if any of these questions..." "Are you sure you don't want a proper drink?"
asked Satchwell, who had ordered a beer.
"I hate drinking on me own."
"Well, I'm driving, you see," said Robin.
"You could stay over."
"Not with me, don't worry,"
he said quickly, with a grin that on a man so elderly resembled a satyr's leer.
"I mean, go to an hotel, file expenses. I expect you're taking a good chunk of money from Margot's family for this, are you?"
Robin merely smiled and said, "I need to get back to London. We're quite busy. It would be really useful to get some background on Margot," she continued.
"How did you meet?"
He told her the story she already knew, about how he'd been taken to the Playboy Club by a client, and seen there the leggy 19-year-old in her bunny ears and tail.
"And you stuck up a friendship?"
"Well," said Satchwell, "I don't know that I call it that."
With his cold eye upon Robin, he said,
"We had a very strong sexual connection. She was a virgin when we met, you know."
Robin kept smiling formally. He wasn't going to embarrass her.
"She was 19, I was 25. Beautiful girl," he sighed. "Wish I kept the pictures I took of her. But after she disappeared, I felt wrong about having them."
Robin heard Una again. "He took pictures of her, you know, pictures."
It must be those revealing or obscene photos Satchel was talking about, because after all, he'd hardly have felt guilty about having a snapshot. The waitress came back with Satchwell's beer and Robin's Diet Coke. They ordered food. After swiftly scanning the menu, Robin asked for a chicken and bacon salad. Satchwell ordered steak and chips. When the waitress had gone, Robin asked, though she knew the answer,
"How long were you together?"
"Couple of years, all told. We broke up, then got back together. She didn't like me using other models. Jealous. Not cut out for an artist's muse, Margot. Didn't like sitting still and not talking." "Nah, I fell hard for Margot Bamborough. Yeah, there was a damn sight more to her than being a bunny girl."
Of course there was, thought Robin, though still smiling politely. She became a bloody doctor.
"Did you ever paint her?"
"Yeah," said Satchwell. "Few times. Some sketches and one full-size picture. I sold them. Needed the cash. Wish I hadn't."
He fell into a momentary abstraction, his uncovered eyes surveying the pub, and Robin wondered whether old memories were genuinely resurfacing behind the heavily tanned face, which was so deeply lined and dark it might have been carved from teak, or whether he was playing the part that was expected of him when he said quietly,
"Hell of a girl, Margot Bamborough."
He took a sip of his beer, then said,
"It's her husband who's hired you, is it?"
"No," said Robin. "Her daughter."
"Oh,"
said Satchwell, nodding.
"Yeah, of course, there was a kid. She didn't look as though she'd had a baby when I met her after they got married. Slim as ever. Both my wives put on about a stone with each of our kids."
"How many children have you got?" asked Robin, politely. She wanted the food to hurry up. It was harder to walk out once food was in front of you, and some instinct told her that Paul Satchwell's whimsical mood might not last.
5, said Satchwell. 2 with me first wife and 3 with me second. Didn't mean to. We got twins on the last throw. All pretty much grown up now, thank Christ. Kids and art don't mix. I love 'em," he said roughly. "But Cyril Connolly had it right. The enemy of promise is the pram in a bloody hall."
He threw her a brief glance out of his one visible eye and said abruptly,
So her husband still thinks I had something to do with Margot disappearing, does he?
What do you mean by still? Inquired Robin.
He gave my name to the police, said Satchwell. The night she disappeared. Thought she might run off with me. Did you know Margot and I bumped into each other a couple of weeks before she disappeared?
I did, yes, said Robin.
It put ideas into what's-his-name's head, he said. I can't blame him. I suppose it did look fishy. I'd have probably thought the same if my bird had met up with an old flame right before they buggered off. Disappeared, I mean.
The food arrived. Satchwell's steak and chips looked appetizing, but Robin, who'd been too busy concentrating on her questions, hadn't read the small print on the menu. Expecting a plate of salad, she received a wooden platter bearing various ramekins containing hot sausage slices, hummus, and a sticky mess of mayonnaise-coated leaves, a challenging assortment to eat while taking notes.
"Do you want some chips?"
offered Satchwell, pushing the small metal bucket that contained them towards her.
"No, thanks," said Robin, smiling.
She took a bite of a breadstick and continued, her pen in her right hand.
"Did Margot talk about Roy when you bumped into her?"
"A bit," said Satchwell, his mouth full of steak. "She put up a good front. What do you do when you meet the ex, innit? Pretend you think you did the right thing, no regrets."
"Did you think she had regrets?" asked Robin.
"She wasn't happy, I could tell. I thought, nobody's paying you attention. She tried to put a brave face on it, but she struck me as miserable, knackered."
"Did you only see each other the once?"
Satchwell chewed his steak, looking at Robin thoughtfully. At last he swallowed, then said,
"Have you read my police statement?"
"Yes," said Robin.
"Then you know perfectly well,"
said Satchwell, waggling his fork at her, "that it was just the once."
"Don't you?"
He was smiling, trying to pass off the implied admonition as waggish, but Robin felt the spindle-thin spike of aggression.
"So you went for a drink and talked?"
said Robin, smiling, as though she hadn't noticed the undertone, daring him to become defensive, and he continued in a milder tone.
"Yeah, we went to some bar in Camden, not far from my flat. She'd been on an house call to some patient."
Robin made a note.
"And can you remember what you talked about?"
"She told me she'd met her husband at medical school. He was an high flyer and all that."
"What was he?"
said Satchwell, with what seemed to Robin a forced unconcern.
"A cardiologist or something?"
"Hematologist," said Robin.
"What's that, blood?"
"Yeah, she was always impressed by clever people, Margot. Didn't occur to her that they can be shits like anyone else."
"Did you get the impression Dr. Phipps was a shit?" asked Robin lightly.
"Not really," said Satchwell.
"But I was told he had a stick up his arse and was a bit of a mummy's boy."
"Who told you that?" asked Robin, pausing with her pen suspended over her notebook.
"Someone who'd met him," he replied with a slight shrug. "You not married?" he went on, his eyes on Robin's bare left hand.
"Living with someone," said Robin, with a brief smile.
It was the answer she'd learned to give, to shut down flirtation from witnesses and clients, to erect barriers.
Satchwell said, "Ah, I always know if a bird's living with a bloke without marriage, she must be really keen on him. Nothing but her feelings holding her there, is there?"
"I suppose not," said Robin, with a brief smile.
She knew he was trying to disconcert her.
"Did Margot mention anything that might be worrying her, or causing her problems? At home or at work?"
"Told you. It was all window dressing," said Satchwell, munching on fries. "Great job, great husband, nice kid, nice house. She made it."
He swallowed.
"I did the same thing back. Told her I was having an exhibition. Won an award for one of me paintings. In a band, serious girlfriend. Which was a lie," he added, with a slight snort. "I only remember that bird because we split up later that evening. Don't ask me her name now. We haven't been together long. She had long black hair and a massive tattoo of a spider's web round her navel. That's what I mainly remember. Yeah, anyway, I ended it. Seeing Margot again."
He hesitated. His uncovered eye unfocused, he said,
"I was 35. It's a funny age. It starts dawning on you thought is really going to happen to you, not just to other people. What are you, 25?
29, said Robin.
Happens earlier for women, that worrying about getting old thing, said Satchwell. Got kids yet?
No, said Robin.
And then, so Margot didn't say anything to you that might suggest a reason for disappearing voluntarily?
Margot wouldn't have gone away and left everyone in the lurch, said Satchwell,
as positive on the point as Una.
Not Margot. Responsibility was her middle name. She was a good girl, you know. School prefect sort.
So you didn't make any plans to meet again?
No plans, said Satchwell, munching on chips.
I mentioned to her my band was playing at the Dublin Castle the following week. Said, drop in if you're passing. But she said she wouldn't be able to.
Dublin Castle was a pub in Camden,
Satchwell added.
Might still be there.
Yes, said Robin. It is.
I told the investigating officer I'd mentioned the gig to her. Told him I'd have been up for seeing her again if she wanted it. I had nothing to hide.
Robin remembered Strike's opinion that Satchwell volunteering this information seemed almost too helpful, and, trying to dissemble her sudden suspicion, asked,
Did anyone spot Margot at the pub, the night you were playing?
Satchwell took his time before swallowing, then said,
Not as far as I know.
The little wooden Viking you gave her, said Robin, watching him carefully. The one with Brunhilde written on the foot.
The one she had on her desk at work,
he said, with what Robin thought might have been a whiff of gratified vanity.
Yeah, I gave her that in the old days, when we were dating.
Could it be true? Robin wondered. After the acrimonious way Margot and Satchwell had broken up, after he'd locked her in his flat so she couldn't get out to work, after he'd hit her, after she'd married another man, would Margot really have kept Satchwell's silly little gift? Didn't private jokes and nicknames become dead and rotten things after a painful breakup, when the thought of them became almost worse than memories of rows and insults? Robin had given most of Matthew's gifts to charity after she'd found out about his infidelity, including the plush elephant that had been his first Valentine's present, and the jewellery box he'd given her for her 21st. However, Robin could tell Satchwell was going to stick to his story, so she moved to the next question in her notebook. There was a printer's on Clerkenwell Road I think you had an association with.
Come again,
said Satchwell, frowning.
A printer's?
A schoolgirl called Amanda White claimed she saw Margot in an upper window belonging to this printer's on the night.
Really? Said Satchwell. I never had no association with no printer's. Who says I did?
There was a book written in the '80s about Margot's disappearance.
Yeah, I miss that.
It said the printers produced flyers for a nightclub you painted a mural for.
For crying out loud,
said Satchwell, half amused, half exasperated.
That's not an association. It'd be a stretch to call it a coincidence. I've never heard of the bloody place.
Robin made a note and moved to her next question. What did you think of Bill Talbot?
Who?
The investigating officer, the first one, said Robin.
Oh, yeah, said Satchwell, nodding.
Very odd bloke. When I heard afterwards he'd had a breakdown or whatever, I wasn't surprised. Kept asking me what I was doing on random dates. Afterwards, I worked out he was trying to decide whether I was the Essex butcher. He wanted to know my time of birth as well, and what the hell that had to do with anything.
He was trying to draw up your horoscope, said Robin, and she explained Talbot's preoccupation with astrology.
Dento Pastavo, said Satchwell, looking annoyed. Astrology? That's not funny. He was in charge of the case how long?
6 months, said Robin.
Jesus,
said Satchwell, scowling so that the clear tape holding the dressing over his eye crinkled.
I don't think the people around him realized how ill he was until it got too obvious to ignore, said Robin, now pulling a few tagged sheets of paper out of her bag, photocopies of Satchwell's statements to both Talbot and Lawson.
"What's all that?"
he said sharply.
"Your statements to the police," said Robin.
What are they, stars? All over the..."
"They're pentagrams," said Robin.
"This is the statement Talbot took from you. It's just routine," she added, because Satchwell was now looking wary. "We've done it with everyone the police interviewed. I know your statements were double-checked at the time, but I wondered if I could run over them again, in case you remember anything useful." Taking his silence for consent, she continued, "You were alone in your studio on the afternoon of the 11th of October, but you took a call there at 5 from a Mr. Hendricks."
"Hendricks, yeah," said Satchwell.
"He was my agent at the time."
"You went out to eat at a local cafe around 6:30, where you had a conversation with a woman behind the till, which she remembered. Then you went back home to change and out again to meet a few friends in a bar called Joe Bloggs around 8 o'clock. All three friends you were drinking with confirmed your story. Nothing to add to any of that?"
"Nah," said Satchwell.
And Robin thought she detected a slight sense of relief.
"That all sounds right."
"Was it one of those friends who've met Roy Phipps?" Robin asked casually.
"No,"
said Satchwell, unsmiling. And then, changing the subject, he said, "Margot's daughter must be knocking on for 40 now, is she?"
40 last year," said Robin.
"Ella,"
said Satchwell, shaking his head. "Time just..." One of the mahogany brown hands, wrinkled and embellished with heavy silver and turquoise rings, made a smooth motion as of a paper aeroplane in flight.
"And then one day you rolled and you never saw it sneaking up on you."
"When did you move abroad?"
"I didn't mean to move, not first. When travelling, late 75, said Satchwell. He'd nearly finished his steak now.
"What made you..."
"I'd been thinking of travelling for a bit," said Satchwell. "But after Creed killed Margot, it was such a bloody horrible thing, such a shock, I don't know. I wanted a change of scene."
"That's what you think happened to her, do you? Creed killed her." He put the last bit of steak into his mouth, chewed it and swallowed before answering.
"Well, yeah. Obviously, at first, I hoped she'd just walked out on her husband and was holed up somewhere. But then it went on and on, and yeah, everyone thought it was the Essex butcher, including the police. Not just the nutty one, the second one, the one who took over."
"Lawson," said Robin. Satchwell shrugged, as much as to say the officer's name didn't matter, and asked,
"Are you going to interview Creed?"
"Hopefully."
"Why would he tell the truth now?"
"He likes publicity," said Robin. "He might like the idea of making a splash in the newspapers. So Margot disappearing was a shock to you?"
"Well, obviously it was,"
said Satchwell, now probing his teeth with his tongue.
"I'd just seen her again, and I'm not going to pretend I was still in love with her or anything like that, but have you ever been caught up in a police investigation?"
he asked her, with a trace of aggression.
"Yes,"
said Robin. "Several. It was stressful and intimidating every time."
"Well, there you are," said Satchwell, mollified.
"What made you choose Greece?"
"I didn't really. I had an inheritance off my grandmother, and I thought, I'll take some time off, do Europe, paint. Went through France and Italy, and in 76 I arrived in Kos, worked in a bar, painted in me 3 hours, sold quite a few pictures to tourists, met me first wife. Never left," said Satchwell, with a shrug.
"Something else I wanted to ask you," said Robin, moving the police statements to the bottom of a small stack. "We found out about a possible sighting of Margot a week after she disappeared. A sighting that wasn't ever reported to the police."
"Yeah?"
said Satchwell, looking interested.
"Where?"
"In Leamington Spa," said Robin, "in the graveyard of All Saints Church." Satchwell's thick white eyebrows rose, putting strain on the clear tape that was holding the dressing to his eye.
"In All Saints?" he repeated, apparently astonished.
"Looking at graves. Allegedly, she had her hair dyed black."
"Who saw this?"
"A man visiting the area on a motorbike. 2 years later, he told the St. John's practice nurse about it."
"He told a nurse?"
Satchwell's jaw hardened.
"And what else has the nurse told you?"
he said, searching Robin's face. He seemed suddenly and unexpectedly angry.
"Do you know Janice?" asked Robin, wondering why he looked so angry.
"That's her name, is it?"
said Satchwell.
"I couldn't remember."
"You do know her?"
Satchwell put more chips in his mouth. Robin could see that he was trying to decide what to tell her, and she felt that jolt of excitement that made all the long, tedious hours of the job, the sitting around, the sleeplessness, worthwhile.
"She's shit-stirring,"
said Satchwell abruptly. She's a shit-stirrer, that one, that nurse. She and Margot didn't like each other. Margot told me she didn't like her.
When was this?
When we ran into each other, like I told you, in the street. I thought you said she didn't talk about work.
Well, she told me that. They'd had a row or something. I don't know. It was just something she said in passing. She told me she didn't like the nurse,
repeated Satchwell. It was as though a hard mask had surfaced under the leather-dark skin. The slightly comical, crepey-faced charmer had been replaced by a mean, old, one-eyed man. Robin remembered how Matthew's lower face had tautened when angry, giving him the look of a muzzled dog, but she wasn't intimidated. She sensed in Satchwell the same wily instinct for self-preservation as in her ex-husband. Whatever Satchwell might have meted out to Margot, or to the wives who'd left him, he'd think better of slapping Robin in a crowded pub, in the town where his sister still lived.
"You seem angry," Robin said.
"Gear Charlie too. Of course I am. That nurse, what's her name? Trying to implicate me, isn't she? Making up a story to make it look like Margot ran away to be with me."
Janice didn't invent the story. We checked with Mr. Ramage's widow, and she confirmed that her late husband told other people he'd met a missing woman.
"What else has Janice told you?"
he said again. "She never mentioned you," said Robin, now immensely curious. "We had no idea you knew each other."
"But she claims Margot was seen in Lemon and Spa after she disappeared." "Nah, she knows exactly what she's bloody doing."
Satchwell took another chip, ate it, then suddenly got to his feet and walked past Robin, who looked over her shoulder to see him striding into the gents. His back view was older than his front. She could see the pink scalp through the thin white hair, and there was no backside filling out his jeans. Robin guessed he considered the interview finished. However, she had something else up her sleeve. A dangerous something, perhaps, but she'd use it rather than let the interview end here, with more questions raised than answered. It was fully 5 minutes before he reappeared, and she could tell that he'd worked himself up in his absence. Rather than sitting back down, he stood over her as he said,
"I don't think you're a fucking detective. I think you're press."
Seen from below, the tortoise's neck was particularly striking. The chain, the turquoise and the silver rings and the long hair now seemed like fancy dress.
"You can call Anna Phipps and check if you like," said Robin.
"I've got a number here. Why do you think the press would be interested in you?"
"I had enough of them last time. I'm off. I don't need this. I'm supposed to be recuperating."
"One last thing," said Robin, "and you're going to want to hear it." She'd learned the trick from Strike. Stay calm, but assertive. Make them worry what else you've got. Satchwell turned back, his one uncovered eye hard as flint. No trace of flirtation remained, no attempt to patronize her. She was an equal now, an adversary.
"Why don't you sit down?" said Robin. "This won't take long."
After a slight hesitation, Satchwell eased himself back into his seat. His hoary head now blocked the stuffed deer head that hung on the brick wall behind him. From Robin's point of view, the horns appeared to rise directly out of the white hair that fell in limp curls to his shoulders.
"Margot Bamborough knew something about you that you didn't want to get out," said Robin.
"Didn't she?"
He glared at her.
"The pillow dream?" said Robin.
Every line of his face hardened, turning him vulpine. The sunburned chest, wrinkled beneath its white hair, caved as he exhaled.
"Told someone, did she? Who?"
Before Robin could answer, he said,
"Her husband, I suppose. Or that fucking Irish girl, was it?"
His jaws worked, chewing nothing.
"I should never have told her," he said. "That's what you do when you're drunk and you're in love, or whatever the fuck we were. Then I had it playing on my mind for years that she was gonna..."
The sentence ended in silence. "Did she mention it when you met again?" asked Robin, feeling her way, pretending she knew more than she did.
"She asked after my poor mother," said Satchwell. I thought at the time, are you having a go? But I don't think she was. Maybe she'd learn better being a doctor. Maybe she'd changed her views. She'll have seen people like Blanche. A life not worth living. Anyway, he said, leaning forward slightly, I still think it was a dream. All right. I was 6 years old. I dreamed it. And even if it wasn't a dream, they're both dead and gone now, and nobody can say no different. My old mum died in 89. You can't get her for anything now. Poor cow. Single mother, trying to cope with us all on her own. It's merciful, said Satchwell, putting someone out of their misery. A mercy.
He got up, drained beneath his tan, his face sagging, turned and walked away. But at the moment he was about to disappear, he suddenly turned and tottered back to her, his jaw working.
I think, he said, with as much malevolence as he could muster, you're a nasty little bitch.
He left for good this time. Robin's heart rate was barely raised. Her dominant emotion was elation. Pushing her unappetizing ramekins aside, she pulled the little metal bucket he'd left behind towards her and finished the artist's chips.
Chapter 48. Sir Artegall, long having since taken in hand the exploit to him assigned, her highest behest to do, to the seashore he gan his way apply. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Joan's funeral service finished with the hymn most beloved of sailors, Eternal Father, Strong to Save. While the congregation sang the familiar words, Ted, Strike, Dave Polworth, and three of Ted's comrades in the lifeboat service shouldered the coffin back down the aisle of the simple, cream-walled church, with its wooden beams and its stained-glass windows depicting purple-robed St. Maudes, for whom both village and church were named. Flanked by an island tower and a seal on a rock, the saint watched the coffin-bearers pass out of the church. O Saviour, whose almighty word the winds and waves submissive heard, who walked upon the foaming deep and calm amidst the rage did sleep. Polworth, by far the shortest of the six men, walked directly behind Strike, doing his best to bear a fair share of the load. The mourners, many of whom had had to stand at the back of the packed church, or else listen as best they could from outside, formed a respectful circle around the hearse outside as the shining oak box was loaded onto it. Barely a murmur was heard as the rear doors slammed shut on Joan's earthly remains. As the straight-backed undertaker in his thick black overcoat climbed back into the driver's seat, Strike put an arm around Ted's shoulders. Together, they watched the hearse drive out of sight. Strike could feel Ted trembling.
"Look at all these flowers, Ted," said Lucy, whose eyes were swollen shut.
And the three of them turned back to the church to examine the dense bank of sprays, wreaths and bunches that created a jubilant blaze against the exterior wall of the tiny church.
"Beautiful lilies, Ted, look, from Marion and Gary, all the way from Canada."
The congregation was still spilling out of the church to join those outside. All kept a distance from the family while they moved crabwise along the wall of the church. Joan would surely have delighted in the mass of floral tributes, and Strike drew unexpected consolation from messages that Lucy was reading aloud to Ted, whose eyes, like hers, were puffy and red.
"Ian and Judy," she told her uncle, "Terry and Olive." "Loads, aren't there?" said Ted, marvelling.
The now whispering, milling crowd of mourners were doubtless wondering whether it would be heartless to set out immediately for the ship and castle, where the wake was to be held, Strike thought. He couldn't blame them. He too was craving a pint, and perhaps a chaser too.
"With deepest sympathy from Robin, Sam, Andy, Saul and Pat," Lucy read aloud.
She turned to look at Strike, smiling.
"How lovely. Did you tell Robin pink roses were Joan's favourite?"
"Don't think so," said Strike, who hadn't known himself.
The fact that his agency was represented here among the tributes to Joan meant a great deal to him. Unlike Lucy, he'd be travelling back to London alone by train. Even though he'd been craving solitude for the past 10 days, the prospect of his silent attic room was cheerless after these long days of dread and loss. The roses, which were for Joan, were also for him. They said, "You won't be alone. You have something you've built. And all right, it might not be a family, but there are still people who care about you waiting in London." Strike told himself, "People," because there were 5 names on the card, but he turned away thinking only of Robin. Lucy drove Ted and Strike to the Ship and Castle in Ted's car, leaving Greg to follow with the boys. None of them talked in the car. A kind of emotional exhaustion had set in. Joan had known what she was doing, Strike thought, as he watched the familiar street slide past. He was grateful they weren't following to the crematorium, that they would reclaim the body in a form that could be clutched to the chest and borne on a boat, in the quiet of a sunny afternoon to come, just the family, to say their last private farewell. The Ship and Castle's dining room windows looked out over St. Maur's Bay, which was overcast but tranquil. Strike bought Ted and himself pints, saw his uncle safely into a chair among a knot of solicitors' friends, returned to the bar for a double famous grouse, which he downed in one, then carried his pint to the window. The sea was Quaker grey, sparkling occasionally where the silvered fringes of the clouds caught it. Viewed from the hotel window, St. Maur's was a study in mouse and slate, but the little rowing boats perched on the mudflats below provided welcome dabs of cheerful colour.
"You all right, Diddy?"
He turned. Isla was with Polworth, and she reached up and hugged Strike. All 3 of them had been at St. Maur's primary school together. In those days, as Strike remembered it, Isla hadn't liked Polworth much. He'd always been unpopular with female classmates. Over Dave's shoulder, Strike could see Polworth's wife, Penny, chatting with a group of female friends.
"Nick really wanted to be here, Corm, but he had to work," said Isla.
"Of course," said Strike. "It was really good of you to come, Isla."
"I love Joan," she said simply. "Mum and Dad are going to have Ted over on Friday night. Dad's taking him for a round of golf on Tuesday."
The Polworth's 2 daughters, who weren't renowned for their good behaviour, were playing tag among the mourners. The smaller of the 2, Strike could never remember which was Roz and which Mel, dashed around them and clung momentarily to the back of Strike's legs, as though he were a piece of furniture, looking out at her sister before sprinting off again, giggling.
"And we're having Ted over Saturday," said Polworth,
as though nothing had happened. Neither Polworth ever corrected their children unless they were directly inconveniencing their parents.
"So don't worry, Diddy. We'll make sure the old fella's all right."
"Cheers, mate," said Strike, with difficulty.
He hadn't cried in church, hadn't cried all these last horrible days, because there'd been so much to organise, and he found relief in activity. However, the kindness shown by his old friends was seeping through his defences. He wanted to express his gratitude properly, because Polworth hadn't yet permitted him to say all he wanted about the way he'd enabled Strike and Lucy to reach the dying Joan. Before Strike could make a start, however, Penny Polworth joined their group, followed by 2 women Strike didn't recognise, but who were both beaming at him.
"Hi, Corm," said Penny, who was dark-eyed and blunt-nosed, and who'd worn her hair pulled back into a practical ponytail since she was 5.
"Abigail and Lindy really want to meet you."
"Hello," said Strike, unsmiling.
He held out his hand and shook both of theirs, sure that they were about to talk about his detective triumphs and already annoyed. Today, of all days, he wanted to be nothing but Joan's nephew. He assumed that Abigail was Lindy's daughter, because if you remove the younger woman's carefully pencilled, geometrically precise eyebrows and fake tan, they had the same round, flat faces.
"She was ever so proud of you," said Lindy.
"We follow everything about you in the papers,"
said plump Abigail, who seemed to be on the verge of giggling.
"What are you working on now?"
"I don't suppose you can say, can you?"
said Lindy, devouring him with her eyes.
"Do you ever get involved with the royals at all?"
asked Abigail.
"Fuck's sake." "No," said Strike. "Excuse me, need a smoke."
He knew he'd offended them, but didn't care. though he could imagine Joan's disapproval as he walked away from the group by the window. What would it have hurt him, she'd have said, to entertain her friends by talking about his job? Joan had liked to show him off, the nephew who was the closest thing she'd ever have to a son, and it suddenly came back to him, after these long days of guilt, why he'd avoided coming back to the little town for so long. Because he'd found himself slowly stifling under the weight of teacups and doilies and carefully curated conversations, and Joan's suffocating pride and the neighbour's curiosity, and the sidelong glances at his false leg when nobody thought he could see them looking. As he stumped down the hall, he pulled out his mobile and pressed Robin's number without conscious thought.
"Hi,"
she said, sounding mildly surprised to hear from him.
"Hi," said Strike,
pausing on the doorstep of the hotel to pull a cigarette out of the packet with his teeth. He crossed the road and lit it, looking out over the mudflats at the sea.
"Just wanted to check in and to thank you."
"What for?"
"The flowers from the agency. They meant a lot to the family."
"Oh,"
said Robin. "I'm glad. How was the funeral?"
"It was, you know, a funeral," said Strike, watching a seagull bobbing on the tranquil sea. "Anything new your end?"
"Well, yes, actually," said Robin, after a fractional hesitation. "But now's probably not the moment. I'll tell you when you—"
"Now's a great moment," said Strike,
who was yearning for normality, for something to think about that wasn't connected to Joan, or loss, or St. Maur's. So Robin related the story of her interview with Paul Satchwell, and Strike listened in silence. "And then he called me a nasty little bitch," Robin concluded, and left.
"Christ almighty," said Strike, genuinely amazed.
Not only that Robin had managed to draw so much information from Satchwell, but at what she'd found out. "I've just been sitting here looking at records on my phone. I'm back in the Land Rover, going to head home in a bit. Blanche Doris Satchwell died 1945, aged 10. She's buried in a cemetery outside Leamington Spa. Satchwell called it a mercy killing." "Well," Robin corrected herself, "he called it a dream, which was his way of telling Margot, while retaining some plausible deniability, wasn't it? It's a traumatic memory to carry around with you from age 6, though, isn't it?"
"Certainly is," said Strike. "And it gives him a motive of sorts if he thought Margot might tell the authorities."
"Exactly. And what do you think about the Janice bit? Why didn't she tell us she knew Satchwell?"
"Very good question," said Strike. "Go over it again, what he said about Janice."
"When I told him Janice was the one who said Margot was spotted in Leamington Spa, he said she was a shit-stirrer and that she was trying to implicate him somehow in Margot's disappearance."
"Very interesting indeed," said Strike,
frowning at the bobbing seagull, which was staring at the horizon with concentrated intent, its cruel, hooked beak pointing towards the horizon.
"And what was that thing about Roy?"
"He said somebody had told him Roy was a mummy's boy who had a stick up his arse," said Robin. "But he wouldn't tell me who'd said it."
"Doesn't sound much like Janice, but you never know," said Strike. "Well, you've done bloody well, Robin."
"Thanks."
"We'll have a proper catch-up on Bamborough when I get back," said Strike. "Well, we'll need a catch-up on everything."
"Great. I hope the rest of you stays okay," said Robin,
with that note of finality that indicated the call was about to end. Strike wanted to keep her on the line, but she evidently thought she oughtn't monopolize his time in his last afternoon with the grieving family, and he could think of no pretext to keep her talking. They bade each other goodbye, and Strike returned his mobile to his pocket.
"Here you go, Diddy."
Polwarth had emerged from the hotel, carrying a couple of fresh pints. Strike accepted his with thanks, and both turned to face the bay as they drank.
"You back up to London tomorrow, are you?"
said Polwarth.
"Yeah," said Strike. "But not for long. Joan wanted us to take her ashes out on Ted's boat and scatter them at sea."
"Nice idea," said Polwarth.
"Listen, mate, thanks for everything."
"Shut up,"
said Polwarth.
"You do it for me."
"You're right," said Strike. "I would." "Easy to say, you cunt," said Polwarth, without skipping a beat, "seeing as my mum's dead and I don't know where the fuck my dad is." Strike laughed. Well, I'm a private detective. Want me to find him for you?
Fuck no, said Polwarth. Good riddance.
They drank their pints. There was a brief break in the cloud, and the sea was suddenly a carpet of diamonds, and the bobbing seagull a paper white piece of origami. Strike was wondering idly whether Polwarth's passionate devotion to Cornwall was a reaction against his absent Birmingham-born father, when Polwarth spoke up again.
Speaking of fathers, Joan told me yours was looking for a reunion.
She did she?
Don't be narked, said Polwarth. You know what she was like. Wanted me to know you were going through a tough time. Nothing doing, I take it?
No, said Strike. Nothing doing.
The brief silence was broken by the shrieks and yells of Polwarth's two daughters sprinting out of the hotel. Ignoring their father and Strike, they wriggled under the chain separating road from damp shingle and ran out to the water's edge, pursued a moment later by Strike's nephew, Luke, who was holding a couple of cream buns in his hand and clearly intent on throwing them at the girls.
"Oi!" bellowed Strike. "No!"
Luke's face fell.
"They started it,"
he said, turning to show Strike a white smear down the back of his black suit jacket, newly purchased for his great-aunt's funeral.
"And I'm finishing it," said Strike,
while the Polwarth girls giggled, peeking out over the rim of the rowing boat behind which they had taken refuge.
"Put those back where you got 'em."
Glaring at his uncle, Luke took a defiant bite out of one of the buns, then turned and headed back into the hotel.
"Little shit," muttered Strike.
Polwarth watched in a detached way as his girls began to kick cold seawater and sand at each other. Only when the younger girl overbalanced and fell backwards into a foot of icy sea, eliciting a scream of shock, did he react.
"Fuck's sake! Get inside! Come on, don't bloody whine, it's your own fault! Come on! Inside now!"
The three Polwarths headed back into the ship and castle, leaving Strike alone again. The bobbing seagull, which was doubtless used to a tide of tourists, to the chugging and grinding of the Falmouth ferry and the fishing boats passing in and out of the bay every day, had been unfazed by the shrieks and yells of the Polwarth girls. Its sharp eyes were fixed upon something Strike couldn't see, far out at sea. Only when the clouds closed again and the sea darkened to iron did the bird take off at last. Strike's eyes followed it as it soared on wide, curved wings into the distance, away from the shelter of the bay for open sea, ready to resume the hard but necessary business of survival. Part 5. Lusty spring, all dight in leaves of flowers. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Chapter 49. After long storms and tempests overblown, the sun at length his joyous face doth clear. So when as fortune all her spite hath shown, some blissful hours at last must needs appear, else would afflicted wights oft times despair. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. At 8 a.m. on the morning she should have been meeting her estranged husband for mediation, Robin emerged from Tottenham Court Road Station beneath a cerulean sky. The sunshine felt like a minor miracle after the long months of rain and storms, and Robin, who had no surveillance to do today, had put on a dress, glad to be out of her everlasting jeans and sweatshirts. Angry as she felt at Matthew for calling off the session with only 24 hours' notice, "My client regrets that an urgent matter of a personal nature has arisen. Given my own unavailability for the latter part of March, I suggest we find a mutually convenient date in April." Suspicious as she was that Matthew was dragging out the process merely to demonstrate its power and add pressure to give up her claim on their joint account, her spirits were raised by the dusty glow of the early morning sunshine illuminating the eternal roadworks at the top of Charing Cross Road. The truth, which had been borne forcibly upon Robin during the 5 days off that Strike had insisted she take, was that she was happier at work. With no desire to go home to Yorkshire and face the usual barrage of questions from her mother about the divorce and her job, and insufficient funds to get out of London to take a solitary mini-break, she'd spent most of her time taking care of her backlog of chores, or working on the Bamborough case. She had, if not precisely leads, then ideas, and was now heading into the office early in the hope of catching Strike before the business of the day took over. The pneumatic drills drowned out the shouts of workmen in the road as Robin passed, until she reached the shadowy calm of Denmark Street, where the shops hadn't yet opened. Almost at the top of the metal staircase, Robin heard voices emanating from behind the glass office door. In spite of the fact that it was not quite 8:15, the light was already on.
"Morning," said Strike, when she opened the door.
He was standing beside the kettle and looked mildly surprised to see her so early.
"I thought you weren't going to be in until lunchtime."
"Cancelled," said Robin. She wondered whether Strike had forgotten what she'd had on that morning, or whether he was being discreet because Morris was sitting on the fake leather sofa. Though as handsome as ever, Morris's bright blue eyes were bloodshot, and his jaw dark with stubble.
"Hello, stranger," he said. "Look at you. Proper advert for taking it easy."
Robin ignored this comment, but as she hung up her jacket, she found herself wishing she hadn't worn the dress. She greatly resented Morris making her feel self-conscious, but it would have been easier just to have worn jeans as usual.
"Morris has caught Mr. Smith at it with a nanny," said Strike.
"That was quick," said Robin, trying to be generous, wishing Morris hadn't been the one to do it.
"Red-handed. 1:10 this morning," said Morris,
passing Robin a night-vision digital camera.
"Hubby was pretending to be out with the boys. Nanny always has a night off on Tuesdays. Silly fuckers said goodbye on the doorstep. Rookie error."
Robin scrolled slowly through the pictures. The voluptuous nanny, who so resembled Strike's ex, Lorelei, was standing in the doorway of a terraced house, locked in the arms of Mrs. Smith's husband. Morris had captured not only the clinch, but the street name and door number.
"Where is this place?"
Robin asked, flicking past pictures of the clinch.
"Shoreditch. Nanny's best mate rents it," said Morris. "Always useful to have a friend who'll let you use their place for a sneaky shag, eh? I've got her name and details too, so she's about to get dragged into it all as well."
Morris stretched luxuriously on the sofa, arms over his head, and said through a yawn,
"Not often you get a chance to make three women miserable at once, is it?"
"Not to mention the husband," said Robin, looking at the handsome profile of the commodity broker's husband silhouetted against a street lamp as he made his way back to the family car.
"Well, yeah," said Morris, holding his stretch. "Him too."
His T-shirt had ridden up, exposing an expanse of toned abdomen, a fact of which Robin thought he was probably well aware.
"Don't fancy a breakfast meeting, do you?"
Strike asked Robin. He just opened the biscuit tin and found it empty.
"We're overdue a Bamber a catch-up, and I haven't had breakfast."
"Great," said Robin, immediately taking down her jacket again.
"You never take me out for breakfast,"
Morris told Strike, getting up off the sofa. Ignoring this comment, Strike said,
"Good going on, Smith, Morris. I'll let the wife know later. See you tomorrow."
"Terrible, isn't it?" said Robin, as she and Strike walked back out of the black street door onto the cool of Denmark Street, where sunlight still hadn't penetrated. This missing plane. 11 days previously, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 had taken off from Kuala Lumpur and disappeared without trace. More than 200 people were missing. Competing theories about what had happened to the plane had dominated the news for the last week, hijack, crew sabotage, and mechanical failure among them. Robin had been reading about it on the way into work. All those relatives waiting for news. It must surely come soon. An aircraft holding nearly 250 people wasn't as easily lost as a single woman, melting away into the Clerkenwell rain.
"Nightmare for the families," agreed Strike, as they headed out into the sun on Charing Cross Road.
He paused, looking up and down the road.
"I don't want to go to Starbucks."
So they walked to Bar Italia in Frith Street, which lay opposite Ronnie Scott's jazz club, 5 minutes from the office. The small metal tables and chairs outside on the pavement were all unoccupied. In spite of its sunny promise, the March morning air still carried a chill. Every high stool at the counter inside the cafe bore a customer gulping down coffee before starting their working day, while reading news off their phones, or else examining the shelves of produce reflected in the mirror that faced them.
"You're going to be warm enough if we sit out here?"
asked Strike doubtfully, looking from Robin's dress to the counter inside. She was starting to really wish she'd worn her jeans.
"I'll be fine," said Robin, "and I only want a cappuccino. I already ate."
While Strike was buying food and drink, Robin sat down on the cold metal chair, drew her jacket more tightly around her, and opened her bag, with the intention of taking out Talbot's leather notebook, but after a moment's hesitation, she changed her mind and left it where it was. She didn't want Strike to think that she'd been concentrating on Talbot's astrological musings over the last few days, even though she had, in fact, spent many hours poring over the book.
"Cappuccino," said Strike, returning to her and setting the coffee in front of her.
He'd bought himself a double espresso and a mozzarella and salami roll. Sitting down next to her, he said,
"How come mediation was cancelled?"
Pleased he'd remembered, Robin said, "Matthew claims something urgent came up."
"Believe him?"
"No. I think it's more mind games. I wasn't looking forward to it, but at least it would have been over." "So," she said, not wanting to talk about Matthew, "have you got anything new on Bamborough?"
"Not much," said Strike, who'd been working flat out on other cases since his return from Cornwall. "We've got forensics back on that blood smear I found in the book in the Athorns' flat."
"And?"
"Type O positive."
"And did you call Roy to find out?"
"Yeah. Margot was A positive."
"Oh," said Robin.
"My hopes weren't high," said Strike, with a shrug. "It looked like a smear from a paper cut, if anything. I found Mucky Ritchie, though. He's in a private nursing home called St. Peter's in Islington. I had to do a fair bit of impersonation on the phone to get confirmation."
"Great. Do you want me to—"
"No, I told you. Shanker issued stern warnings about upsetting the old bastard, in case his son's got wind of it."
"And you feel, of the two of us, I'm the one who upsets people, do you?"
Strike smirks slightly while chewing his roll. "There's no point rattling Luca Ricci's cage unless we have to. Shanker told me Mucky was gaga, which I hoped meant he was a bit less sharp than he used to be. Might even have worked in our favour. Unfortunately, from what I managed to wheedle out of the nurse, he doesn't talk anymore."
"Not at all?"
"Apparently not. She mentioned it in passing. I tried to find out whether that's because he's depressed or had a stroke, or whether he's demented, in which case questioning him is obviously pointless. But she didn't say. I went to check out the home. I was hoping for some big institutional place where you might slip in and out unnoticed, but it's more like a B&B. They've only got 18 residents. I'd say the chances of getting in there undetected or passing yourself off as a distant cousin are close to zero."
Irrationally, now that Ricci seemed unreachable, Robin, who hadn't been more interested in him than in any other of the suspects, immediately felt as though something crucial to the investigation had been lost.
"I'm not saying I won't take a bash at him, eventually," said Strike. "But right now the possible gains don't justify making a bunch of professional gangsters angry at us. On the other hand, if we've got nothing else come August, I might have to see whether I can get a word or two out of Ricci."
From his tone, Robin guessed that Strike, too, was well aware that more than half their allotted year on the Bamborough case had already elapsed.
"I've also," he continued, "made contact with Margot's biographer, C.B. Oakden, who's playing hard to get. He seems to think he's far more important to the investigation than I do."
"Is he after money?"
"I'd say he's after anything he can get," said Strike. "He seemed as interested in interviewing me as letting me interview him."
"Maybe," suggested Robin, "he's thinking of writing a book about you, like the one he did on Margot." Strike didn't smile.
"He comes across as equal parts wily and stupid. It doesn't seem to have occurred to him that I must know a lot about his dodgy past, given that I managed to track him down after multiple name changes. But I can see how he conned all those old women. He puts up a good show over the phone of knowing and remembering everyone around Margot. There was a real fluency to it. Yes, Dr. Gupta, lovely man. Oh, yes, Irene, bit of a handful. It's convincing until you remember he was 14 when Margot disappeared, and probably met them all a couple of times, tops. But he wouldn't tell me anything about Brenner, which is who I'm really interested in." "I'll need to think about that," he said.
I'm not sure I want to go into that. I've called him twice so far. Both times he tried to divert the conversation back onto me. I dragged it back to Brenner, and he cut the call short, pretending he had something urgent to take care of. Both times he promised to phone me back, but didn't.
You don't think he's recording the calls, do you? Asked Robin. Trying to get stuff about you we can sell to the papers.
It occurred to me, Strike admitted, tipping sugar into his coffee.
Maybe I should talk to him next time.
Might not be a bad idea, said Strike. Anyway, he took a gulp of coffee. That's all I've done on Bamborough since I got back. But I'm planning to drop in on Nurse Janice the moment I've got a couple of clear hours. She'll be back from Dubai by now, and I want to know why she never mentioned she knew Paul Satchwell. Don't think I'll warn her I'm coming this time. There's something to be said for catching people unawares. So, what's new your end?
Well, said Robin, Gloria Conti, or Jabert, as she is these days, hasn't answered Anna's email.
Pity, said Strike, frowning. I thought she'd be more likely to talk to us if Anna asked.
So did I. I think it's worth giving it another week, then getting Anna to prod her. The worst that can happen is another definite no. In slightly better news, I'm supposed to be speaking to Amanda White, who's now Amanda Laws, later today.
How much is that costing us?
Nothing. I appealed to her better nature, said Robin. And she pretended to be persuaded, but I can tell she's quite enamoured of the idea of publicity. And she likes the idea of you, and of getting a name in the papers again as the plucky schoolgirl who stuck to her woman-in-the-window story, even when the police didn't believe her. That's in spite of the fact that her whole shtick, when I first contacted her, was that she didn't want to go through all the stress of press interest again unless she got money out of it.
"She's still married?" asked Strike, taking his cigarettes out of his pocket. "Because she and Oakden sound like a good match. Mightn't be a bad sideline for us, setting grifters up with each other."
Robin laughed. So that they can have dodgy children together, thus keeping us in business forever." Strike lit his cigarette, exhaled, and then said,
"Not a perfect business plan. There's no guarantee breeding two shits together will produce a third shit. I've known decent people who were raised by complete bastards, and vice versa."
"You're nature over nurture, are you?" asked Robin.
"Maybe," said Strike. "My three nephews were all raised the same, weren't they? And
one's lovely, one's a prick, and one's an arsehole," said Robin.
Strike's loud burst of laughter seemed to offend the harried-looking suited man, who was hurrying past with a mobile pressed to his ear.
"Well remembered," Strike said, still grinning as he watched the scowling man march out of sight.
Lately he too had had moods where the sound of other people's cheerfulness grated. But at this moment, with the sunshine, the good coffee, and Robin beside him, he suddenly realized he was happier than he'd been in months.
"People are never raised the same way, though," said Robin. "Not even in the same house with the same parents. Birth order matters and all kinds of other things. Speaking of which, Wilma Bayliss's daughter, Maya, has definitely agreed to talk to us. We're trying to find a convenient date. I think I told you the youngest sister is recovering from breast cancer, so I don't want to hassle them."
"And there's something else," said Robin, feeling self-conscious.
Strike, who'd returned to his sandwich, saw to his surprise Robin drawing from her bag Talbot's leather-bound notebook, which Strike had assumed was still in the locked filing cabinet in the office.
"I've been looking back through this."
"Think I missed something, do you?" said Strike,
through a mouthful of bread.
"No, I..."
"It's fine," he said. "Perfectly possible. Nobody's infallible."
Sunshine was slowly making its way into Frith Street now, and the pages of the old notebook glowed yellow as Robin opened it.
"Well, it's about Scorpio. You remember Scorpio?"
"The person whose death Margot might have been worried about."
"Exactly. You thought Scorpio might be Steve Douthwaite's married girlfriend, who killed herself."
"I'm open to other theories," said Strike.
His sandwich finished, he brushed off his hands and took out his cigarettes.
"The notes ask whether Aquarius confronted Pisces, don't they? Which I assumed meant Margot confronted Douthwaite."
In spite of his neutral tone, Strike resented remembering these star signs.